Coming up on this edition of the Black Vault Radio, political activist Stephen Bassett steps into the vault to talk about his more than two-decade effort to get the U.S. government to lift the shroud of secrecy over the extraterrestrial presence.
This is serious business. Mm-hmm. This is not trivial. Matter of this ET thing was absolutely going to be classified. And that's what I've been doing, political activism, engaging the government to try to convince them to do one simple thing, and that's to tell us, yeah, there's ETs here. The only reason that is not universally known is the United States government has gone to tremendous lengths to undermine that acknowledgement.
All that and much more. So stay tuned. The Black Vault Radio is about to begin. More than 20 years ago, I began a journey, my quest for the truth. My name is John Greenwald, and I have hammered the United States government with Freedom of Information Act requests, trying to get answers. I have more than 2 million pages of declassified documents for you to download at theblackvault.com. Now, I attempt to dive even deeper and talk to some of the most brilliant minds on this planet. No government secret is off limits, and no question is off the table. All I aim for is the truth. This is the Black Vault Radio. That's right, everybody. This is the Black Vault Radio. I am your host, John Greenwald Jr. Thank you, as always, for tuning in and making this show your podcast of choice to listen to on whichever way you choose to do so. If you're not aware, I am available not only on iTunes, but also the Google Play Store and Stitcher, TuneIn. You can subscribe to all of that. There's quite a few other sites now that are hosting the show and the feeds to subscribe. But also one other thing now that you can log into, which I got a lot of requests for, and I must apologize. I think I mentioned it last episode. Everything is up and running now, though. That is the raw RSS feed. If you don't know what that is, don't worry about it. But if you're looking for it, it is now online. Just find the RSS button and go ahead and click on that. That'll give you the RSS feed so you can input that into whatever software program that you choose. Coming up in the TBV Dialogue segment, I'm excited about this conversation with my friend, Mr. Stephen Bassett. Steve and I have known each other for many, many years, and although we have our same objectives, sometimes we have fun debates and conversations because we don't always agree. But it is fun, and it is informative in the sense that I always learn something from him. It's not where I want to just sit and fight and debate with him. It's fun to listen to him because I do learn things all the time, and hopefully vice versa as well. But I've always enjoyed speaking with him, and it's going to be a great time here on the Black Vault Radio with him. So that is coming up. Now, there is one thing that I want to talk about briefly here, and that is what I'm seeing, not necessarily with you listening. So I don't want you to be offended with this, but I do want you to kind of be aware of it. Because I'm seeing it more and more, and it's worrisome in the sense that there is a lot of misinformation out there. Now, I'm not going to jump on the whole fake news soapbox right now, but that is starting to be an epidemic. Now, for those that do follow the Black Vault on social networking, you may have seen a post that I did on the passing of Senator John McCain. Now, although I don't agree with all of Senator McCain's policies, especially those as of late, I do believe that he is somebody who should be honored. You take politics out of the equation. He was a good person, and I think that he should be honored here as he passes on to the next life or wherever he may be going on to. Now, that being said, I posted this not expecting that every troll would come out of the woodwork and start attacking for just posting a message about the passing of a senator. Now, I will say that it wasn't all bad. In fact, if you count them all, statistically, they were mostly good. But it's the negative that always sticks out to me. Like, well, what is, you know, I'm not putting any political beliefs in this. In fact, I disagree with Senator McCain's latter politics in his career. So I wasn't really sure. And I was reading through many of the attacks that they couldn't believe that I would support such a man. The majority, and I'm talking the vast majority, and I'm talking 99% of the majority, all were talking about regurgitated past political campaign garbage that's been years disproven and debunked. Now, why am I bringing this up? I'm not trying to make it political here on the Black Vault Radio, though politics are going to come up, because as much as you guys don't like it, as much as I don't like it, as much as the world doesn't like it, politics plays a role in government secrecy, and that's what this show is all about. But what really bothered me about this is transcending well beyond the world of politics. I'll give you another example right here on the Black Vault Radio. Quite a few episodes ago now, I interviewed Dr. Aaron Judkins, and Dr. Judkins talked about the scientific anomalies that exist in our past, or at least what he has found and what he believes. I couldn't believe some of the reactions to that show. Now, although that is one of actually the most downloaded episodes of the Black Vault Radio, and yet again, the majority of the feedback was good, it's very interesting to see that when people hear something that they don't necessarily agree with, they just have to attack. There's no discussion or debate with many people anymore. It's just attack, attack, attack. My biggest goal with this radio show is to bring the truth, or at least as much as I can, to the table to help everyone formulate an idea. And that includes me. I learn things on this show all the time. That's why I love doing it. That's why I love having fun bringing people on and picking their brain. I don't necessarily always agree with everything. And in fact, all the guests that I brought on, I don't agree with everything, Dr. Judkins included. But that's okay. I'm not threatened by anything that he's going to bring to the table. Going back to my original story about the John McCain post, the vast majority of that, when I was saying the 99%, 99% of those comments not only were attacks, but were based on these incorrect facts. Where do they come from? The internet. And the internet is rampant with these rumors. And the problem is that people, once they hear them, they think it's true. Why? Because it was in a meme, or they heard about it in some kind of, you know, very politically slanted Facebook group or website. And let's face it, I don't like the phrase, but there are fake news sites out there that are satire, or they just don't care about the accuracy, but they sound legitimate. And the moment they sound legitimate, people read the headline and the headline only. And I was amazed, and this is my bigger point, because I want to accomplish this with this show, and that is get through the mess. We need to be able to take 30 seconds, maybe, to do a Google search. And you know what's funny? All I said is I recommended in another comment, and I got attacked for this. I said, just Google, you know, XYZ. If you read something on the internet, generally, if it is a wild claim, it's been researched before. So it may be true. I'm not saying everything is false. It may be true. All you got to do is take 30 seconds, Google it, see what comes up. See what kind of sites have researched it already, because they give you a starting point. I'm not saying all of them are unbiased, but what I am saying is gives you a starting point. Just because I said Google something, somebody came after me and said, oh, well, Google is slanted, and if that's where you get your news, then, you know, no wonder you feel that way and this and that. That is a scary situation that we are in right now, where a lot of people don't believe anything. They only believe whatever they want to, but it's not based on fact, not based on documents, not based on anything other than they read it once and they have it in their head, and they'll morph it throughout the years, and they just think it's true. Here's the example. The USS Forrestal fire caused by John McCain, quote unquote. highly debunked. No official documents confirm that at all. So in order for people to still believe that, and that, you know, Senator McCain is some evil guy who killed 140 sailors, at least that's what the conspiracy is. And yes, by the way, I have looked into this and tried to get official documents. Zero evidence of a cover-up. When you put the official documents in front of people, they just immediately say, oh, it's a big cover-up, that the documents are all fake. All hundreds and hundreds of pages of official documents on the Forrestal fire are completely fake. Now, that's, again, a very scary situation where if you don't believe anything, then why be online? You know, why even take part in online discussions? And that's what I want to convey to you guys is with this show, I want to get beyond that. I want to get beyond the whole fake news, the whole satire, the whole internet rumor, and get to the root of it. And we should not be afraid to research. We should not be afraid to fact check. I have changed my mind on quite a few things over the last 22 years since I have entered the Freedom of Information Act realm, and I have fired off FOIA requests on pretty much every government secret you can imagine. And I've changed my mind because I'm not afraid to look. My biggest message to you as we move on with this program, and even the internet as a whole, if you use this as a starting point, which I hope you do, and branch off and go online and research, whether it be what Mr. Stephen Bassett is about to talk about coming up, or what Dr. Aaron Judkins had talked about, or what Dr. John Alexander had talked about, or what Stanton Friedman has discovered, all of these names that I bring to the table are for discussion. And the minute that everybody goes to some kind of evil attack because it's something that they don't agree with, I'm telling you, that is not a great place to be in. So my biggest advice to everybody, including myself, I tell myself this every day, don't be afraid to hear something you don't necessarily believe. Because if you are that reactive to it, if you get that upset where you just have to spout off, I'm not saying this to you personally. So when you're thinking, wait a minute, is this guy talking to me? I hope not, probably not. But to some out there, and you'll see your family members and friends on Facebook do this too, if you're that threatened by hearing somebody else's point of view or politics or whatever it might be, that is a sign that maybe their beliefs are not as secure as they want them to be. And that's a shame. There's a lot of things I don't know. And this program, what I want to do and accomplish is learn myself. And in the process, pass it all on to you guys. So my biggest advice, don't be afraid to hear something new and to fact check what you have believed. Because every time I've challenged all of those people that attacked me, and you can check it out. Most of them I haven't deleted. I did delete the vulgar ones because people do get pretty vicious. But I let people speak their mind. And if you disagree with me, that's okay. That's all right. You can post and say, you know, Senator McCain was bad and how dare I believe it and this, that, and the other thing. But most of the people that I did say, okay, look, if you're going to say he caused that fire, if you're going to say that he really talked during, you know, his time as a POW, which, by the way, there's no evidence of that, big shocker. If you believe all that, all I ask in return is show evidence, anything. And it's funny because I did that on multiple occasions. Not a single person, as of the recording of this episode, backed up those wild claims. And when they said that they said that they would look, they were crickets from there on out. One guy even decided to start cussing a blue streak because he couldn't find any evidence. So why not just fall back and cussing someone out? So I hope that all that made sense. I didn't mean to go on too much of a rant, but I at least wanted to give you guys a little bit of insight that in this day and age, with the resources that we have, most of the time within 30 seconds, we can challenge one of those headlines or memes or forwards or likes or shares or whatever from that you're seeing from family, friends, and colleagues, 30 seconds on Google, and we can challenge it, confirm it, or leave it a question mark. Who knows? But I do highly recommend we all take a few moments to research. That being said, let me go ahead and deal with some headlines now on TBV News. In this episode's TBV News segment, the segment where I talk about some headlines that you may or may not have missed from our last episode, since the broadcast of our last episode, I'm going to start with a headline that comes to us from about 254 miles above the Earth's surface. Now, if you weren't paying attention to the news, don't worry, you probably wouldn't have seen it anyway, because it's not really making a whole lot of headlines. But the International Space Station sprung a leak. On Wednesday night, they saw evidence that there was some kind of an air leak, although it was minute. You wouldn't know that from the few headlines that did surface about this. It just kind of seemed like the whole thing was depressurizing. That's actually not the case. They are fairly safe, but I'm bringing it up just to kind of say that we often forget that the International Space Station is still up there with people on board, with the astronauts on board, and they sprung a leak this week. Apparently, they are fairly determined that the leak is found. It is on the Russian side of the spacecraft, and they are working to fix the situation. They continue to monitor it. I do wish them all the best up there. They are all heroes in my book. I have a lot of respect for astronauts and the work they do in space. Very often overlooked, with my father working in the space program, being instrumental in getting the space shuttle off the ground. My grandfather worked in rocketry, which led to the development of the Apollo program. There's a special place in my heart for all of those things, and I try and keep up to date with what's going on up there. It's pretty hard, though, because sadly, the news just doesn't pay attention to anything of what's going on in space. Except when you say Space Force, then all of a sudden everything is like a big deal. If you don't say Space Force, many people don't even know that there's a space station up there with people on it. But I hope that you do pay attention to that. I do wish them all the best. It does look like they're going to be okay. On the UFO front, if you saw a viral video off the coast of San Diego, rumors flew that another Phoenix Lights type situation occurred off the coast of California, Southern California. And again, very indicative to what the Phoenix Lights were. Lights in the sky, bright, fiery-looking orbs, as they're described. And a lot of the videos went viral very quickly on the internet, in the sense that people were saying that there was a major sighting, lots of witnesses, over a big city. Sadly, though, not as much truth to it as some of those original witnesses wanted us all to believe, that they were seeing UFOs and so on. It was the military, and the military's explanation, very much like what was the Phoenix Lights, was that they were aircraft flares being dropped off the coast in a training exercise or a military test drill. It was about 30 miles off the coast. Well, everybody saw these things and automatically went to a UFO. Now, who knows? Maybe they were or were not. To me, they do look like aircraft flares. They do not really look like the Phoenix Lights sighting once you really kind of sit down and analyze the videos that surfaced online and look back at what the Phoenix Lights photos were. They do look very, very different. Interesting to note, though, the military did have the same explanation for the Phoenix Lights back in 1997. The problem was, and this is my connection to the case, I was within about a year or two starting the Black Vault, and I filed a Freedom of Information Act request to Luke Air Force Base. Now, why Luke Air Force Base? Well, they were in the vicinity of where the Phoenix Lights were, and that's who the Pentagon blamed for launching the flares, meaning, look, you all saw UFOs, quote-unquote, but it's not that. There was a training exercise. Jets flew out of Luke Air Force Base, dropped aircraft flares. That's what everybody saw. Well, I got a letter. I still have it. It's on the Black Vault. In fact, I'll link it in the show notes, www.theblackvault.com/show notes. Look for episode number 9. That's what you're listening to. And they sent me a letter. Luke Air Force Base sent me a letter in response to my FOIA request. They said, we didn't drop any flares. So whatever the Pentagon said it was not true. Because whomever concocted that story, and this is what I find funny, nobody from the Pentagon picked up the phone, called Luke Air Force Base and said, hey guys, by the way, if anybody asks, if anybody files a FOIA request, you guys launched aircraft flares, which explain the Phoenix Lights. Nobody did that. So when I pursued it and fact-checked that story, I found something pretty darn interesting, which was the fact that they did not do that. And so who knows if that is going to happen with this San Diego sighting here in late August of 2018. Again, they do look like aircraft flares in my opinion, so it won't surprise me if they actually are. Plus, I would hope that from 1997 to 2018, they've learned their lesson, saying if a UFO is an aircraft flare, they can back it up. But that being said, that was definitely probably the most viral story UFO related that I saw anyway, but sadly did not turn out to be anything. This next story is kind of an update to something that I talked about long ago here on the Black Vault Radio. I don't remember how many episodes, but I talked about Alex Jones. And Alex Jones, and this kind of ties into my, I hate to call it a rant, and I'm sorry that I went on a little bit of a rant there in the beginning, but some of these rumors, these internet lore legends that get passed around and then people hear them and think they're true. One person, that is responsible for many of these very, very far out there conspiracy theories is Alex Jones. Now, Alex Jones is facing multiple lawsuits the last time I checked, one of which was by multiple families of the Sandy Hook tragedy and the Sandy Hook shooting. Well, Alex Jones went on the record quite a few times to say that that just didn't happen. That the people that you saw in the videos, the tears, the tragedies, the heartbreak, that was all fake. That the entire thing was what's called a false flag. And that none of it took place. I don't support rumors like that. There is a point and a morality line when it comes to conspiracy theories, and I've talked about that on a couple occasions. Now, if there's evidence to support it, that's fine. But there's nothing to support this. Well, he was very vocal about it. And finally, some of the families had enough and they're taking him to court. The news this week and the update is the fact that Alex Jones's attorney, decided to submit a motion to dismiss and that they wanted to get this defamation lawsuit against him dropped. The judge said, no way. They are entering the courtroom. They're going to go ahead and actually go to trial, and we'll see where we end up. Now, the reason I've brought it up here on the program before is the fact that many decided to say that this was a free speech issue, and by him getting Twitter, Facebook, whatever social networks that have yanked Alex Jones's channels, that that was a disregard for his First Amendment right. But there's a line between a First Amendment right and downright fabricating information. That's why they have defamation and slander laws, that you can't just say whatever you want about someone or a group of people or whomever. You can't just go around doing that over and over and over, because look what happens. People start believing that it's true. People get chastised in the street. People get their finger pointed at them. Their daughter or their son was killed in a tragic school shooting, and that mom or dad is being insulted that they were faking it, that they're just nothing more than an actor or an actress. That's why this lawsuit is there, not a First Amendment right issue. It's to take away the right of somebody to just belittle, defame, and slander somebody until it's too late. I'll be watching that trial. We'll give some updates, but I do think it is something that does need to go to trial, and a jury does need to decide about all of these fake news issues. I hope all of you understand how important all of that is and how detrimental it can be to society. Now, that's the news. Coming up on the TBV Dialogue segment, my friend Mr. Stephen Bassett, political activist and one who has devoted decades to try and get what he calls the truth embargo by the United States government and even world governments. He wants to end all of that. He wants the extraterrestrial presence known and acknowledged by the government. That's coming up on the TBV Dialogue segment. In this episode's TBV Dialogue segment, I welcome political activist Mr. Stephen Bassett. Stephen is the executive director of Paradigm Research Group, or PRG, founded in 1996. His efforts aim to end the shroud of secrecy over the truth about the extraterrestrial-related phenomena. He's been heard on more than 1,000 radio and television programs, and he's spoken to audiences throughout the globe. His work has been covered and featured by national and international media, including being featured on CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, Washington Post, New York Times, New York Magazine, Washington Times, Chicago Tribune, and many others. In 2013, PRG produced a citizens' hearing on disclosure at the National Press Club in Washington. And in November of 2014, PRG launched two political initiatives in Washington. One sought the first hearings on Capitol Hill since 1968 regarding the extraterrestrial presence issue. The other sought to inject the ET issue into the 2016 presidential campaign. Mr. Stephen Bassett, thank you so much for joining me and spending some time here on the air on the Black Vault Radio.
Well, it's my pleasure, John. Absolutely.
I've been a fan of your work for a long time. You are one of the few that just gets out there. You know, so many people, you know, they sit on their chairs and they don't do much. You are quite the opposite. You get out there, you make a difference, you try to make an impact, you do make an impact. I give you a lot of credit for that. Let me ask you and get into kind of your background. Why do you do what you do as a political activist, and why do you try and raise issue to this particular topic versus everything else?
As you can imagine, there's many, many issues out there.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do them all. You got to pick one. I made my choice in 1995. It was the winter of 95. And it was a life thing. I just was very unhappy with what I was doing, which just really didn't amount to much. And I wanted to try to, well, to make a difference, to do something that was perhaps could be of some value. Kind of a midlife crisis, really. I was 49.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some guys will go buy a red convertible. Some will join the Peace Corps. There's all kinds of things you might do at a point like that. I made the interesting decision that this issue, which I had always been interested in and followed, but not directly engaged, would be something that, wow, what if I could become part of that, get involved with that? But of course, how and in what way? I was influenced at that particular time by a number of things, but one of the most important things that influenced me was John Mack's book, Alien Abduction. The fact that a Harvard-trained psychiatrist with a Pulitzer Prize had stepped into this issue. I guess it had been about 4 years since he stepped in before I sort of became aware of it, and took that risk.
Mm-hmm.
And was dealing with contactees was a profound, I think, change. It indicated that things were maturing. I looked into a few other things, went to a conference, and realized that at circa the end of 1995, this issue was certainly, well, far further along than it was when I first became aware of it as a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And through all those years. And so I thought, wow, I have a science background. I'm not a physicist, but I have a degree in physics. I'm interested in science. The issue is profound. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge risk. I mean, it could have absolutely amounted to nothing. It could have been just 6 months and blew. It's gone, and I would have had to wander through life for another couple of decades. However, I got really lucky. I made a couple of key decisions, which for me at the time was unusual because I was making mostly bad decisions. One was I had learned in my life that there's nothing you really can't get involved in if you're willing to volunteer, if you're willing to work for free. And that was the first thing. Second one is that, well, what if my opening move was to try to go volunteer for John Mack and his people and in Cambridge,
mm-hmm.
go there. What a tremendous door to walk through. And I guess I had a fire in the belly and it's kind of pumped up. And I corresponded with their manager, the manager of his operation, which is called the Program for Extraordinary Experience Research, PEER. It's gone now, obviously because of his unfortunate death in London. And I convinced them to let me come and be a volunteer, mm-hmm. without actually meeting me in person. And so it was on, I finally arrived in Cambridge on January the 26th of 2000, of 1996. And I spent a number of months there, about 4 months, just hanging around and trying to do some development work or wherever, at any way I could assist. And it was exciting. It was empowering. I felt like I was kind of at the center of the universe. But I wasn't a fit, really. This was an academic operation. And it wasn't my temperament, and I didn't have probably the right background. And I wasn't a researcher, per se, really. But while I was up there, I had an epiphany. I was kind of sitting in the office there in Cambridge and looking out the window. And in a few words, it was this, that the evidence for the ET presence is overwhelming. It's been massive. It was proven decades ago. The problem isn't evidence. It's not science. It's politics. Mm-hmm. There's a political barrier here, not a scientific barrier. And who's engaging that? Who is formally engaging the politics of the ET issue, which is really the politics of the truth embargo, or what was formerly called the UFO cover-up? No one, really. And I said, gee, I'll go do that. Mm-hmm. And as it happened, I had family in the Washington area, so I had a place to stay, free. I had a car. I knew Washington. I'd lived in and out of Washington many times. I knew it pretty well. So I'm thinking I can go there, set up, register as a lobbyist, which should attract some attention, and start kind of in a political engagement. I wasn't exactly sure how that would go, how the media respond, but I felt, you know, I don't know, you probably experienced this in your life when you don't know exactly how things are going to work out, but you have this real strong sense that it's definitely going to work out.
Yeah.
And so I went down, registered as a lobbyist, and it didn't take long for the Washington Post to turn up at my door and got some articles and began this political engagement as a political activist. Essentially, that's what I was, who was a lobbyist. Lobbying is only one part of political activism. I mean, you can be a political activist without being a lobbyist. And it's now 22 years in. And that's what I've been doing, political activism, engaging the government to try to convince them to do one simple thing. And that's to tell us, yeah, there's ETs here.
Was there any experience that you had? Because, again, going back to that original, hey, I got to pick something. There has to be, well, there doesn't have to be, but in generally speaking, there's usually something that pulls you, like a personal experience, encounter, anything like that. Just to clarify, did you have anything like that, or did you just see the evidence and you realize the evidence is enough to pull me in that direction?
You're right. I'd had no experiences whatsoever. Nothing. Not even anything remotely paranormal. I'm a left brain guy. I was going to be a physicist, an astrophysicist, but things just sort of didn't go well back then in the middle of the Vietnam War. So I just got a BS in physics, but I never had an experience at all. This was an intellectual decision. Well, it was also emotional in that I desperately really needed to find something that I could really put myself into, something bigger than myself. But it was an intellectual decision. Based on the evidence. The word believer, of course, to me is an insult, and I encourage people not to use it, and I try not to say I believe in this or I believe in that. I do not believe in the presence of extraterrestrials, just like I don't believe there are atoms. I am convinced there are atoms and other subatomic particles because of the overwhelming evidence confirming it, and that's the case for the ET presence. The evidence is overwhelming, and the only reason that is not universally known is the United States government has gone to tremendous lengths to undermine that acknowledgement, that formal conviction.
In those beginning days, because I'm sure your answer to this question will have morphed in the past 22 years, but in those beginning days that pulled you to it, what was some of that evidence that you were seeing? Obviously, you worked with John Mack and looked into the abduction phenomena, but what was that evidence that pulled you in?
It's interesting. First of all, there were articles, of course, about this phenomena that were published in media all throughout my lifetime. Certainly going back to when I could pay attention. But the fact is, going all the way back to when I was born, 1946. at my website, paradigmresearchgroup.org, I have a section called the Print Media Archive, where I have 10,000 of those articles linked, and you can go read them. The total number of articles that have been written in the mainstream media since 1947 is probably more in the range of maybe 25,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't count foreign language articles. So there were articles appearing all through these years.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they're interesting. Who cannot be interested in that? And so I read the Look magazine article about Betty and Barney Hill. I read other articles about this and that over the years. And to my mind, well, it's obvious what's going on. That's extraterrestrial. And I noted, I remember thinking, well, we'll be told about this anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be confirmed. So there's that. And obviously, this covers a range of things. The media has written this subject up, God knows, for the last 60 years. What the media did not do, for whatever reason, which might have included some substantial government pressure, was to go Woodward and Bernstein on it. In other words, they didn't assign teams of investigative reporters to go push the Pentagon or other agencies and really hammer them with questions, like the Boston Globe did on the Catholic scandals,
mm-hmm.
right? The abuse. They put a team, I think it was the Globe, one of the Boston papers, put a team together, and they went and broke that story. And it was a major story, won the Pulitzer Prize. No, that did not happen, and there's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, they wrote it up, so one could see that. And then when I started paying closer attention, it was obvious. You had pilot sightings, you did have some video, you had photographs, you had radar reports, you've got witnesses coming forward from within the government. You've got, of course, sightings all the way around the world. How many, we don't know. Could have been millions, tens of thousands of them reported. And then you have the contact evidence,
mm-hmm.
which is the most extraordinary of all. Over a half a million, well over a half a million individuals have privately communicated their contact experience to researchers without any expectation of money or fame. And there is a consistency to the testimony, meaning that similar types of ET, similar experiences, and all of these people are not, this is not all coming from sleep paralysis. This is powerful firsthand testimony. You put it all together, and in the collective, it's overwhelming. You can never point to a single piece of evidence and say, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
That's true in any trial. It's true in science. It just doesn't work that way. Because you could point to a perfectly clear photograph. It's hoaxed.
Yeah.
You could point to a high-level person giving testimony. They're lying. But the collective evidence will convict beyond a reasonable doubt. And so it is it is that totality of evidence, which you obviously are familiar with,
mm-hmm.
That is overwhelming.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely overwhelming. And increasingly, more and more people agree to that. I mean, they understand that. And they understand, wait a minute, the fix is in here, right?
Mm-hmm.
you can pile evidence up to the roof. Doesn't matter. The government is just saying, no, it's not true, or it's not real, or it's not important, or whatever. And the government's very powerful.
Yeah.
Government is not trivial. You don't mess with it. You can challenge it. I challenge it. But when the government says you can't go to Cuba, you don't go to Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Or they put you in jail. So it's like that. So that's the answer. The idea of the smoking gun is a myth in a sense. But anybody who looks into the evidence with serious intent, I can't imagine they can come to any other conclusion.
And I'm not challenging the number. I'm curious because I don't know a whole lot about abductions. I know on the surface, obviously, the phenomena, but, I'm a document guy, so I don't really know. You had mentioned mm-hmm. over a half a million people have come forward privately to researchers or investigators. I'm curious, where does that number come from? Is that an estimate? Is that cataloged? Where does that come from?
There are many, many researchers in the world on mm-hmm. the subject, obviously. And you can imagine that if you're a known researcher on this subject, that you're the person that people are going to get in touch with.
Mm-hmm.
If they have an experience and they can't talk to their family, they can't talk to their friends, but they want to tell someone, they're going to send an email or a letter to one of the researchers.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been getting these letters for 20, almost 30 years. Now, as it happens, Whitley Strieber, who obviously is one of the best known contactees in history, and devoted pretty much the rest of his life to, well, not totally the rest of his life, but certainly has devoted a tremendous amount of his life to writing about it, talking about it. And his wife was his, obviously, full partner in all of this, Anne Strieber.
Yeah.
He indicated quite a number of years ago that as of, could have been as long as 10 years ago, that since his initial book, Communion,
mm-hmm.
they had received over 500,000
wow.
Emails and letters. And Anne read every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of her major contribution. And then she wrote a book, Communion Letters, in which she kind of talked about the kinds of things that were coming in. And so with that number in mind, and then considering that there are quite a few researchers around the world, dozens, I can only imagine the total yeah. number that have been submitted. So I'm comfortable with that mm-hmm. number, but it could be 200,000. That's still.
Yeah. Regardless. I mean, it's just a lot. I just was curious
but
about
it's a big
studies.
Number.
Yeah. Now
yes.
you also bring up the media, which I fault on many occasions for many things, but that they haven't put forth the effort to explore this issue even recently, to be honest with you. And you may disagree with me on that. But over the decades, they haven't put forward those teams like they have on these scandals or, you know, making mm-hmm. a particular church look bad or a particular politician or whomever, you know, fill in the blank. But it's seemingly like a hot potato that nobody wants to touch this issue. And when they do, it's very popular with their audiences and their readers. So why they don't, I don't know. Mm-hmm. December of last year was a prime example that people want this information. And then they touch it, and then they're like, oh, we got to pass it on. That's our quota for the next, you know, 2, 3, 4 years for a serious article. Why do you think for decades now the media focusing in on them is seemingly afraid to touch this? Because as you said, the evidence is overwhelming. So why are they afraid of it?
Well, they do touch it.
They touch it, but no teams.
They've written thousands of articles,
mm-hmm.
but they haven't gone Woodward and Bernstein on it. This is the truth embargo. The truth embargo is a very, very complicated history, which will deservedly get a tremendous amount of attention, certainly post-disclosure. Many books are going to be written about it. Maybe I'll write one.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But this is no trivial matter. To sum it up in as few words as possible, the situation is pretty well known, and that is this. We developed atomic bomb technology at the end of the war. We dropped two of those bombs and started building more as fast as we could in 46 and certainly into 47. We learned by early 47 that the Soviets were also going to build bombs. They hadn't gotten them yet, but they had the technology, they had the secrets, and they were going to do it. And I don't think anybody doubted that. An Iron Curtain was already across Europe, according to Winston Churchill. So the situation circa July of 1947, right, early 1947, was that our government, our military and intelligence community, which was formidable,
mm-hmm.
though the intelligence community was still early, made up of a lot of pretty serious people who had just defeated the Axis powers in the biggest war in all of history, were confronted with the fact that there was going to be another war, which is the way it works, and it was going to be nuclear this time.
Mm-hmm.
So they were facing an existential reality, and I'm sure they took it quite seriously. At the same time, E.T. started turning up everywhere, and that was no accident in my view. Sightings all around the world. At the time, again, we're talking 1947, no internet, three three fledgling television networks, lots of papers. And so we'll never know the full extent of how many people saw how many things in that period, but there were plenty of sightings they reported. And then, of course, you have to crash at Roswell in July. And now the government, whatever they might have known prior to July, it was now absolutely certain within their circles that we have an ET presence here. Mm-hmm. We have one of their vehicles. We have bodies. And we still have the threat of a third nuclear world war. This is serious business. Mm-hmm. This is not trivial. These are serious times, and these are serious people. And they made a decision, which I don't want to second guess it. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I didn't have to make it, that the entire matter of this ET thing was absolutely going to be classified. It was going to be dealt with by the government alone. And that every effort will be made to keep it that way to the best of their ability. And, of course, they had a formidable challenge because it wasn't like, oh, we're building a bomb and it's the Manhattan Project and we're just going to not tell anybody. This is about an ET presence, and the ETs could come and go as they pleased. Mm-hmm. They could fly anywhere they wanted. And so they were faced with, how do we contain a public awareness, acknowledgement, whatever, of a phenomena that we cannot control? Mm-hmm. That was their challenge, and it was a formidable one. And it wasn't easy, but they pulled it off. What they first had to do was to get the newspapers under control. The television was easy. Mm-hmm. These are fledgling networks operating under the Federal Communications Commission, meaning they have to be licensed and held. Back then, you couldn't even say hell. There were so many restrictions. And so all they had to do was go to the owners of these television networks, CBS, NBC, and basically say, this is off limits. You will not deal with this in any way that threatens policy that we're going to be instituting. And I'm sure they got instant cooperation. It was mm-hmm. like, no problem. And they had to go to the papers. Did they have to go to every newspaper in the country? No. They needed to deal with the publishers of just the key ones, the major ones, certainly New York Times, Washington Post, and so forth. Basically, this is off limits, in a sense. I mean, in other words, you're not going to challenge it. You're not going to come after the subject. You can write up something that happens. If there's a sighting, you can write it up. And they got the paper on board. All right. And again, this is 1947, and they're talking to these publishers or this network executive. They're saying, you know, we may be facing down a nuclear power in the Soviet Union within 2 years.
Yeah,
we're dealing with the potential of nuclear war. We've got ET situation here. This must be contained. Nobody was going to, you know, stand up to them and say, oh, they are just being ridiculous. No. So they got things under control early.
Yeah.
And they pretty much held things under control all the way through the 50s and into the 60s. But they had a couple of serious challenges. The biggest one was, of course, the July 1952 events that were directly over Washington, D.C. And that's when they really got serious mm-hmm. about the embargo. That's when it got even more institutionalized. Mm-hmm. And I think at that point, after 52, if you were somebody that decided to go Edward Snowden on this issue, the chances were it wasn't going to end well for you. So, okay. So I think the intent was, we were either going to have a nuclear war, in which case, who the hell, it'll matter whether ETs are here or not here, or we're going to get past this and have bilateral relationships with the Soviet Union. We're going to reach understandings and we're going to stop building thousands of nuclear weapons. This thing will get resolved. And at that point, once it was resolved and we were no longer under this threat of a third world war, then the idea of bringing this information to the public would have been much more palatable. That, I think, was probably in their mind. What they didn't know, mm-hmm. and didn't know even as late as 52, that this non-war, this Cold War, was going to last 44 years. And during those 44 years, the eight nations were going to build somewhere between 80 and 90,000 nuclear weapons, enough to destroy entire civilization hundreds of times over. Utter madness, which is why they called it MAD, mutual assured destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And as those, so for that 44-year period, nobody, it just got worse and worse and worse. The weapons got bigger. They got on submarines. They're on mobile launchers. They're all over the place. And we nearly had a nuclear war in 62. There were several other times we damn near had a nuclear war. No one is going to raise their hand inside the military intelligence complex and say, you know, I think maybe it's time to tell the truth about this ET thing. Let's get this out there.
Yeah.
No way. So it's locked down. So by the time the Cold War is over in 1991, the truth embargo had become just institutionalized. It was simply baked in to the American culture and our allies as well, meaning, we don't go there.
Yeah.
We don't do that. We don't do this. We got plenty of problems, plenty of things to deal with, and it was just baked in. And it was also obviously not being disclosed by the Soviet Union, eventually Russia, and by the Communist China for their own reasons, and they had some very damn good reasons not to tell people about it too. And so the first opportunity to probably see a major breakthrough on this was when the Cold War ends in 91. And that would have been under George Bush, H.W. But he was tied up in a war in Iraq. And, of course, they needed a little time to sort of think it through. But very possibly, had George H.W. Bush won a second term, because he was the ideal president for them to make a maneuver like this, they might have falsely told the American people under George H.W. Bush, but he didn't win a second term.
Mm-hmm.
Clinton did. And he was unacceptable to the military intelligence complex, regardless of the fact that Rockefeller came in the door and said, hey, let's do this. Let's get the information out. And so we enter the post-Cold War part of the truth embargo, which is now in its 27th year. And so it's easy to explain why the newspapers have held their ground, stayed between the lines up to 91. As you go from 91 forward, it's a little more difficult to explain it. And then, of course, the media starts metastasizing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's spreading out horizontally. And you got media of every kind, and the internet comes in. And the challenge of maintaining that embargo grew and grew and grew and grew. But the fact is, and I have, as I said, I've archived 10,000 articles, I've read them all. If you actually look at the media coverage, you can see the transition, you can see the changes, you can see some efforts to push it. And the fact is that for that and many other reasons, the truth embargo at this point is basically hanging by a thread. 27 years after the Cold War, a long time if you're an activist. I mean, I didn't think it would take this long. My Lord, but historically, in terms of how long it takes major activist movements or huge changes to happen,
mm-hmm.
it's not that long.
I want to go back to the 50s just for the audience. Steve, you probably are familiar with these, but just to kind of give context for your belief, and I agree with this, that the government itself was controlling the media. There are documents to support this, not necessarily on the extraterrestrial issue, but controlling the media as a whole. It was called Operation Mockingbird, and it is something that I've got documents
yeah.
on, and largely, in my belief anyway, after researching it, trying to anyway, for many years, there's not a whole lot of documents on it. Very much like the MKUltra and mind control records, most likely those things were destroyed many years ago. Sadly, that happens when the government's when our government tries to cover something up. So the idea mm-hmm. of controlling the media, it is documented. Even though I do believe a lot of those documents have been destroyed, there are records to support that the CIA had this program. When did they start it? In the early 1950s. And so it completely mm-hmm. coincides with your point that around this time frame, as ETs are, exploding, in your words, just these cases are coming around from coast to coast and beyond. If the government wanted to control the media, they absolutely could have. How do we know it? Because it's documented. So I did want to point that out to you, to the audience, because Steve, I'm sure you're familiar mm-hmm. with those records and that program.
Yeah.
But again, it is documented. And for me, when you try and understand topics like this, a lot of times you won't find the quote unquote smoking gun or proof of extraterrestrials, but you look at other parts of history and all of a sudden it all makes sense. And then you can actually think, hey, wait a minute, all of this is very plausible.
Certainly. And of course, your life's work has primarily been about documents. You've created the Black Vault and you've got thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of documents there, which if someone were to read them all, they'd be very enlightening, but who's got the time, right?
Yeah.
But I encourage people to avoid the dualistic thinking. I mean, this is one of the great, this is one of the bugaboos in the Western thought, which is dualistic thinking. Black, white, up, down, in, out, bad, good, evil, you know, satanic, evil, good. It's never like that. It's always such more complicated. So there is and has been a relationship between American journalism and the military intelligence complex, without question.
Do you think... I'm sorry, go ahead.
But the idea that they're controlling... meaning they're literally controlling it. No. There has been plenty of hardcore, tough, solid, wonderful, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalism that's done over the last 70 years. And a lot of that journalism has caused a lot of trouble for people in power. Trouble for the government, trouble for the military, trouble for presidents, and so forth. Journalism has been doing its job. Is it perfect? No. And in some areas, have they failed? Yes. Certainly, if you consider that the people have a right to know the truth in ED presence and should have known a long time ago, then yeah, the journalisms have failed us in that regard. But what we have is that in the post-World War II era, the era of the Cold War, the era of the existential nuclear Damocles sword, which we got used to, which is what humans do. We get used to anything.
Mm-hmm.
We got used to the fact that at any moment there could be a nuclear war and it would all be over.
Mm-hmm.
And we went on with our lives. But those that were in charge of preventing a nuclear war, or just playing the game, the global game of risk, it was not something they get used to. They had to deal with it. And so they felt they had to have some hooks into the journalism world, and they certainly did that. They planted journalists and what have you, and on times and occasion they would actually probably go to media and ask their cooperation, maybe even on occasion demand their cooperation. I mean, there's a story, you can't run this, it's national security, and so forth. They have leaked information to journalists that was not true. And standard things like that. Have they done it as bad as a lot of other countries? Obviously not.
Mm-hmm.
We're not communist China. We're not the Soviet Union. We're not even Russia. But is our journalistic world living up to its highest ideals as expressed by the founders of modern journalism? Not always.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not clear cut. It's not one or the other. But we want, as a minimum amount, we want a full, free, and independent press. We want a minimum amount of interference by government, both either political or military intelligence, in journalism. And one of the reforms that I hope will happen post-disclosure, amongst many others, is that we will move in that direction, and there will be less of that as the history of all of this comes forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to keep this non-dualistic approach to everything that I do with respect to these issues. Right now, we're in a highly dualistic time where everything is one or the other, extreme partisanship, extreme ideologies, and as a result, almost everyone's missing the mark, and that's not good. I mean, no one's going to win here when we get to places like that. And so we need to get off of that. Hopefully we will. But that's how, so you're right. They did it. Exactly how much interference, we don't know. All the details, we don't know. How other areas they may have interfered, we don't know. But has real journalism also happened? Absolutely.
So let me ask your definition of disclosure. There's a lot of different definitions floating out there. What is, What is your definition when you're working towards disclosure? Mm-hmm. What is that?
Yeah, it's a luxury that as one of the first and only, well, we'll say full-time political activists on the subject, but I'm not the only one, is that we defined it. In other words, we simplified it for ourselves by defining it. So here it is, here's what it is, right? This is what we defined it as. Other people can define it any way they want to, but mm-hmm. in terms of the movement, it's well-defined. Disclosure is an event in this case.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a new definition. And one day, when you go look at the definition of disclosure in the dictionary, you're going to find this listed as one of the definitions. Disclosure is an event, is capital D. It is the term that is used to refer to that moment when either the first head of state or in a coalition of heads of state, though I seriously doubt it would be a coalition, formally informs the citizens of their nation, his or her nation, that yes, the government is fully aware there's an extraterrestrial presence, that they have withheld the formal acknowledgement of that for national security reasons up until that moment, but they're telling you now.
Mm-hmm.
That is it. The moment those words come out of the, you know, it could be a tweet, it could be a, you know, a letter, it'll be an announcement in front of an audience. The moment those words come out of the head of state of a nation, that is disclosure. And mm-hmm. it's over right then. Boom. It's over instantly. Now, after that, we're in the post-disclosure world. So that's exactly what it is. Now, small d disclosure is obviously the revealing of information. And so far, I understand that. That's been going on for decades. It's never stopped.
Mm-hmm.
But the disclosure that the activist movement talks about, and this is confusing, and I accept that. It's okay. You have to define your terms if you're going to be a successful activist. You can't be an activist on other people's terms, particularly the government's terms, which would like to change the language and always tries to. Meaning, oh, this is not what you're trying to get. This is what, no. That is what it is. It is the formal acknowledgement by heads of state of the extraterrestrial presence that's engaging us.
Do you think, just a point of clarification, in that disclosure, well, actually, no, let me not say that. In the reality of the ET presence, do you believe in the collusion and communication aspect to what many believe out there, that the governments are colluding with aliens somehow or communicating? Or do you believe they just know they are there and don't know how to communicate and there is no secret deal? They're just there. They can do whatever they want. Which side of that, okay, if any, do you fall on?
First of all, I do try as best I can, but it's not easy to avoid the word belief or belief.
Yeah, and I didn't mean, I know not, you said not, that, but
I know. I'm not trying to be critical. In other words, what does the evidence tell me regarding the issue of collusion?
Yeah,
I do not believe it's been proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm-hmm.
I believe there. Within the evidence that has turned up that I think is credible, there are some hints that there might be interaction. For instance, if, as I believe is the case, one of the ETs was alive after the Roswell crash for some length of time, then obviously for a period there was some sort of interaction between us and that ET. Okay, fine.
Mm-hmm.
We know from the contact evidence that there is interaction between humans and ETs, on ETs' terms, of course.
Mm-hmm.
They're telepathic. They can communicate with you and they can read your mind, so forth. Okay, fine. So that's interaction. We know that the number of contactees is very large. And based upon just the numbers that we think, even the low-end numbers we think that are actually having contact, there's absolutely no reason to believe that there aren't people within the Pentagon, within the Army, within the Air Force, even within the executive branch of the congressional branch of government that are not contactees. They probably are.
Mm-hmm.
And very likely they are keeping that to themselves, but some of them may not. It may be that they're contactees that are working in the military intelligence and they're telling everything they know and trying to cooperate. That's a form of interaction. there's speculation that Eisenhower may have gone to have a meeting or see an ET. That would not be surprising at all. But was it alive? Was it dead? And what happened when he went? Obviously, because the truth embargo, we're left to come up with our own theories.
Yeah.
And there's thousands of them. And of course, if you're going to make a theory and you want people to pay attention, make it a good one. And so one of the good ones is that they met, there were treaties signed, agreements were made, technology exchange for contact, all of this stuff hasn't been proven.
Mm-hmm.
There have been instances where contactees have in their recollections, whether it be direct memory or hypnotically regressed memory, where they thought that they saw a human military person, maybe in uniform, on the craft with the ETs that was dealing with them. Given the fact that the ETs can make you see anything they want you to see, practically, that is a little problematic.
Mm-hmm.
But if true, would be very significant. And there's also some indications of being in a base where people said they've seen an ET with it. But this is thin gruel. This is not the kind of evidence that one can then write a book and say, there's arrangements going on. If I had to bet, I would say there is no formal agreement, or collusions, nor do I believe that ETs are controlling heads of state. I would bet against that, but it wouldn't shock me to find out that there's something along those lines.
Yeah,
this is one of the problems of a truth embargo. A lot of very smart people spend a great deal of time trying to figure out a puzzle that's missing 90% of the pieces, and also suffering from the disinformation and the truth embargo. It wastes our time. It wastes our life. We need to know the truth and the facts, and then we can start doing meaningful, purposeful, constructive activity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just one reason of thousands of reasons that the truth embargo needs to end. It's a complicated answer to your question, but right now I do not believe that collusion or treaties has been established even close to a reasonable doubt.
Yeah, no, and that's fair. I mean, I agree with you. I was surprised one time, just to give you a quick story, I had been asked about the disclosure process by George Norrie on his television program, Beyond Belief. And mm-hmm. I was surprised at the hate mail that I received, because we were talking about disclosure. And I said, it's quite possible that when disclosure happens, and you might disagree with this, and in fact, I think you probably will. But I said, when disclosure happens, the reality is there's really not much to disclose because they don't know about it. They know the phenomena is there. And people hate me for saying phenomena. I believe there are different aspects. I do say it's plural, but the phenomena mm-hmm. is there. They do believe that there's an extraterrestrial connection because there's nothing else that it could be, but they have zero idea about who they are, what they are, why they're here, this, that, and the other thing. And I didn't, very much like you had just said, there's really not evidence to show the collusion. I didn't think that was that bad of an answer. And man, did I get, because I didn't say the government is shaking hands and allowing them to abduct people. Maybe it was the audience. Maybe it was the time frame. I really don't know. I was amazed, though, of the audience reaction. Do you believe that there is any possibility that it is just downright the government has zero clue? And to me, that is the national security risk. I do believe that the ET presence makes sense. To me, that's the most plausible. Not to do a shameless plug, but I'm coming out with a book in a couple months. And that's what I do, is I take every skeptical explanation of UFOs, the UFO phenomenon, and government documents, right? Just the hardcore stuff that I can prove to you. Take every skeptical explanation, and I show, in my opinion, the ET thing is the only thing that makes sense. But do you think that there's a possibility the government just has zero clue whatsoever?
No. Let's parse this a little bit. First and foremost, the government has access to all of the public domain work, including the Black Vault. All right. So in a sense, they've had all of these countless thousands of perfectly fine American citizens and others around the world diligently trying to study this phenomena for 70 years, going out, interviewing people with sightings, gathering reports, cataloging them, and of course all the contactee evidence, all of this just doing their work for them. So they have all of that. Right? Now, let's consider that what the citizen science effort has divulged and found out. Now let's and how little resource it had. Now let's consider the government with vast, unlimited resources and all kinds of super high-tech stuff. So let's start with the base. First of all, they've been tracking them for 70 years. They've got gun camera footage of these craft operating, and of course radar footage and whatever. So they have a lot of information about their performance capabilities. And then, of course, you've got the crashes. Ryan Wood wrote an important book called Magic Eyes Only, in which he did something kind of cool. He I think it was about 75 crashes that he wrote about in this book. And these events have a very substantial spectrum of evidence for them. In other words, you've got some like Roswell where you have huge amounts of evidence, and you've got some others in there that have very little, but there's something there. So he chronicled. And so you get 75. I'm pretty confident that the U.S. government, at least the U.S. government, but I think I have to include the Soviet government as well. Now, Russia have had a number of crash vehicles that they have obtained over the years. And, of course, they have studied them to death. They have studied them down to the molecule level and learned everything they possibly can and re-engineered anything they could. And there's evidence for this. We've got the Corso evidence. We've got others that have been talking about these craft being seen or models being seen. There's nothing shocking here. So they've been studying ET craft and ET technology for 70 years. That's a lot right there. All right, we've got that. Okay, we've got whatever they've learned about the contact. I'm pretty sure that the government has gone to some lengths to try to learn as much as they can about what happens between humans and ETs during contact events.
Look, I don't disagree with that. I do believe that they've looked into it and know something. I think my bigger point, where I was so surprised that there was such a negative reaction to it, was my belief at this point, and again, I think you and I respectfully disagree on it, but I think my point is the government just doesn't know. Do they know that the phenomena is real? And yes, I do, again, believe it's plural. Do they believe that it's real? Yes, they do. Do I believe that they think that there is an extraterrestrial connection? Probably. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of these theories about collusion and communication, and they know and they have bodies and this and that, maybe they do, but I guarantee they don't understand it. They're not communicating and they're not colluding, because I use that anthill analogy, and that is where if the government is trying to communicate with an extraterrestrial race that is able to get here, that they're able to traverse the stars and they've got 100,000 or 500,000 or a million year head start, if they're able to get here, if aliens are able to get here, I do not believe that the government has any capability, not just the government, the human race, has any capability to communicate. And I think at the end of the day, that lack of ability to communicate paves the way that there is no collusion. And then that paves the way to the fact and reality that they just don't have any idea, that they don't have any clue. I think you said it, that they can't fight against it. There's nothing that they can do. That in itself is that national security risk. But I would comfortably say that's probably a topic for a whole nother show. Now, with all that being said, towards the end of the show, I like to do a segment called TBV Mailbag. This is the segment where listeners will find out who the guest is, send in their questions. And where I wanted to go next with the interview is kind of the first question that came in from Herbert H. From the Bronx, New York. From Bronx, New York. He writes, "I have been around on this planet a long time, and I feel I may leave soon. I have watched and waited for something to be, quote, disclosed by the governments of the world, but nothing has happened. I've resigned to the fact it won't happen in my lifetime, but do you think concrete evidence will be disclosed in my 8 grandchildren's lives? Now, that's kind of where I wanted to go with this, Steve. You had mentioned earlier in the program that you felt it was kind of still hanging, the secrecy, the truth embargo was hanging on by a thread. Yeah. Do you think we're close? Do you think it's about to happen? Or do you think this is still going to take decades?
No. It can happen at any time, literally. And the principal reason for that is that there's more heads of state than just the President of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Putin is the number one, I think, right now, candidate. Meaning, if you had to say who would be the first right now, I'd say Putin. But he's not the only one. There are a number of other countries that could make a dramatic decision to yank this out from under the U.S.'s now 70-year prerogative. There's that. But there's also other developments.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I can't get into this in depth. I can only be brief. On my website, there's huge amounts of material under the paradigmresearchgroup.org under main projects. Look for the 2016 election initiative. That's for openers. And then under issues, you can see a tremendous amount of information about the To the Stars Academy of Arts and Sciences. I've got like 90 video interviews and video news articles on it. To make a long story short, Bill Clinton was blocked from bringing the information out. He could have been the disclosure president. He was stonewalled, but nothing surprising there. And he then ran for a second term, and then the Republicans took over the White House. The Clinton political team made a decision back then that they weren't going to talk about what happened, but they were going to deal with this issue one day. It was going to be their issue. It's going to be the disclosure issue for them. And let's be clear, the head of state who makes the first announcement will go down in history. It will be one of the greatest, if not the greatest, political legacy of all time. It will empower that person, will empower their party, will empower the country. Clinton's wanted that. Hillary wanted that. Over the intervening years, they would refer to the issue from time to time. John Podesta was the principal person. In fact, he was really the only one. Though Bill Clinton did a couple of things. Hillary said nothing, but Podesta said a number of things. And they sort of kept the thing alive. Her first chance to become the president and be the disclosure president was, of course, the 2008 election. She was the preemptive favorite. She lost that election. The next 8 years were interesting, but disclosure did not happen. Going into the 2016 election, she was an overwhelming favorite to win. And fair enough. Paradigm Research Group, did a citizen hearing on disclosure, delivered that to the Congress November 2014. And I went to D.C. at about 50,000. I lost a political initiative into the media and finally was able to force the connection between the entire Clinton political team, her husband, herself, John Podesta, and the ET issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it got picked up by the media in the middle of this intense campaign. Ultimately, 400 articles were written about this connection, including 130 referring to me personally. And the issue, and it forced the Clintons, meaning herself, her husband, John Podesta, and even Obama, to actually address the issue in the campaign in carefully selected interviews on television and also in print. This had never happened before. The 400 articles represented more political coverage of this issue than in the entire 70 years prior. The plan was for Clinton to disclose. She was going to win the White House and disclose. The military intelligence complex noticed this. They not only know that they've been talking about it, they knew about the Rockefeller Initiative, they saw these hundreds of articles being written, and they saw the comments that she was making. She didn't want to make them, but she had no choice because the reporters were pressing them for responses, which they couldn't give them, so they had to give controlled responses. I know this because I was dealing with 40-some of those reporters. The military intelligence complex made a fateful decision. They put together in 2015 a plan to come forward with kind of a public relations project.
Mm-hmm.
Why did they do this? Because they knew that if she becomes president and discloses, that they were going to get thrown under the bus. It was going to be their fault. They wouldn't tell. they blocked the president, they stonewalled, they did this, they did that, they're the bad guys, and they don't see themselves as the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And so they decided that they're going to get this out there ahead of her presidency, meaning her inauguration, January 20, 2017. And so, as it happened, a fellow named Tom DeLonge, a musician who's intensely interested in this issue, lots of money, had been bugging them for some time to talk about his ideas. And lo and behold, what he wanted to do corresponded with what they wanted to do. And so they came together to create a project, which ultimately was released in October of last year, called the Two Stars Academy. But in fact, their intention, I believe, was to announce this project right after the election, after her winning the election in November. And the project is now well-known, can be easily found, Two Stars Academy, in which 10 individuals with long-standing careers in intelligence, in science, and in the Department of Defense, all retired, no longer working for the government, formed an organization with the intention of bringing information to the public on this subject.
Mm-hmm.
Not violating security oaths, nothing classified, but recently declassified stuff as provided to them, and also putting their careers and their name behind this effort. It's unprecedented. It had never happened before. It's the most powerful group of individuals ever assembled in the public domain to address this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science. Unfortunately for them and their effort, she didn't win. And when she didn't win, the whole thing blew sky high. That's how close we came. We came about 70,000 votes over three states from having disclosure probably in early of 2017. And so when that didn't happen, they had to step back. Some people dropped out because they got exposed. Their names got exposed in the WikiLeaks dump of Podesta's emails.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to decide what to do next. Do they wait a definite period until they see a situation? I don't think they had any concern that the new president was going to disclose. It was not even on the radar, in my view. What do you do? And they could have done that. They could have waited until at least after the midterms. They could have waited 3 years. But instead, they announced in October of 2017. Actually, it was October 11th.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it in the Facebook video. Why did they do that? I don't know, but I have a pretty good idea. And that is because of Putin. Not only was Putin obviously hugely in the news and being identified as the enemy of the state and wanting to disrupt America, cause us problems, drive us crazy. I mean, that had now become virtually endemic. But for 20-some years, nearly 20 years, I have been talking about the fact that Putin or Xi Jinping or another head of state could disclose and yank that out from under us. Mm-hmm. In other words, take that legacy away. It's been out there. I've done it hundreds of times. Not because I love Putin or necessarily want Russia to be first, but because the fact is it can happen. And the White House and the Pentagon damn well need to be aware of that, and that's the only way I can convey that to them. But more importantly, in May of 2017, I actually went to Moscow and gave an interview to one of their national television networks, REN-TV, in which I went into depth about Putin as the disclosure president and exopolitics and some of these issues relating between the two countries. No one had ever said this in Russian media, let alone in Russian soil. That interview was eventually provided to me, and I put it up on the net in late 2017, January 2018. And it was covered in a couple of articles. I sent out a press release on it. Our press completely stayed away from it. I mean, they didn't touch it with a 10-foot pole.
Mm-hmm.
But it was written up in Sputnik, and it was also written up in several UK papers. But the point is, the government's fully aware that I went there. They knew I did the interview. The Putin thing was far definitely advanced in their mind. And their problem was this. They could sit on this if they wanted to, but Putin could yank the plug. And if they were concerned of what would happen to the military intelligence complex if, say, Clinton had won and disclosed and they weren't out ahead of this issue,
mm-hmm.
for Putin to do it, for Putin to go in front of the Russian people and say there's an extraterrestrial presence here, and the American people immediately just charge down to the White House and the Pentagon, why didn't you tell us, why didn't you tell us, why didn't you tell us? Everybody gets thrown under the bus. It's a geopolitical catastrophe for the United States. Mm-hmm. And so they, I believe that for that reason, they said, we've got to go ahead. And they did. And they launched on October 11th. They made it clear what their intentions were. They then did some selected interviews with the New York Times, providing a story to them, which the Times verified and published in those December 16th articles. Major story. First release of gun camera footage ever from the United States military. Revealing of this Pentagon study that was done to humor Harry Reid, that involved Bigelow. Bigelow is actually kind of part of the To the Stars Academy, though he's not an official member. Bigelow, ahead of that October 11th announcement, goes on 60 Minutes and says flat out to the reporter there's an extraterrestrial presence. So that is happening. In other words, right now, circa August of 2018, the disclosure movement, the movement to get the announcement, the confirmation, which I've been a part of for 22 years, is being led by the military intelligence complex. Mm-hmm. This group, and allegedly as many as 30 or 40 people inside still, who are not outside, who are supporting them, backing them up, because they're not operating out here as rogue operation. And so that is a highly charged situation. And frankly, I got to tell you, I think once the political situation settles down, it's very likely that disclosure could happen in 2019.
And that leads to another question that was sent in. They didn't want to be identified. An anonymous question. Any chance Donald Trump's rather large mouth will spill anything in a tweet? On that note, so you do think it is the Trump administration as a whole, maybe not Trump personally, but as a whole, that this is going to kind of break free?
I don't know what the administration is going to be circa 2019. I don't think it's going to be what we have now. It's going to be different. We're about to go through, we're already in a constitutional crisis, and it's about to get a lot deeper. Mm-hmm. And some really extraordinary things are going to happen between now and January of next year. In other words, we're in the middle of a hurricane. And so I'm standing under with a hurricane going on, trying to say what's going to happen next. I don't really know. I know that there's going to be some profound things. And so in the new situation, whatever it is, when things have settled down, in other words, the storm is passed. That doesn't mean that there isn't issues. There will be issues, but the storm is passed. I think it's possible that they will then accelerate the To the Stars Academy people will accelerate. They've been slow walking this deliberately, right, for some time. But I think things will pick up in 2019. That's about the best I can say.
Yeah, oh, that's
fair. At this point. It's again, because of the Putin issue.
Yeah.
That's the problem. Unless Putin is working for the CIA, and he's on their payroll, he can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants, and that includes taking the legacy of being the disclosure president.
Yeah. Well, let's do a couple quick other ones, and then I'll let you go, Stephen. I know you're a busy guy. Laura Rogers, listening in from Canada, she wrote in, who do you feel is the most credible person out there in the world of the disclosure movement?
Oh, God. Well, first of all, I do not, I just generally don't do critiques and or assessments of other people in the field. This is not an inclusive list. All right. But, I really have high confidence in certainly Richard Dolan.
Mm-hmm.
I have extremely high confidence in you.
No, thank you.
I think Grant Cameron has done some excellent work,
mm-hmm.
and so forth. These are some of my close colleagues. But there's plenty of other people that could easily be named here.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say this. Look, this is a free-for-all. This is the Wild West now. We're just learning to understand and adapt to what the Internet is and what it can do. And we're just starting to deal with the power of the collective. In other words, it's not a question of 1955, pick up the New York Times and read what some reporters have written, but rather you can go online and you can get 100 million opinions if you want to. Everybody's a journalist. Everybody's a documentarist. Everybody's in play. And the quality of the information is obviously incredibly degraded.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a criticism. It's just, you know, just simple truth, right? It's like backyard gossip, right? You're gossiping with your neighbor over the fence. You don't think of that as like an article that's been researched for 5 years in the New York Times. And so it's a mess, and it's very hard. And there's a lot of pains and problems that are coming from this. And we didn't ask for the internet. It was handed to us. We didn't ask for Facebook. We didn't ask for all of this. It was basically handed to us. We like it. It's cool. We use it. But the power of it, we haven't even begun to properly appreciate. And so, believe me, there's going to be a lot of problems as a civilization come to grips with the most powerful networking and communication technology in all of time, mm-hmm. in all of human time. So it's a mess. And I try to be understanding. I never argue with people on the net. I do not respond to
that. I should heed that advice.
It's not going to work. I mean, let people say what they're going to say. But one thing I do encourage everyone, look, if you can get an education, get it. And get the best you can.
Yeah.
And once you've gotten that education, use every ounce of it to try to figure out and assess what areas on the internet can you get good information, and where is the nonsense, to be able to sort the wheat from the chaff. And if you don't have an education, and many people don't, much of it, they have no way of doing that.
Yeah.
They're completely wide open. And so this is the future. The future is educate your kids, train them how to use the internet, and figure out where the truth is and where the BS is. And the more you can do that, the better the quality of life you're going to have.
It's funny you bring that up. Before I brought you on in the beginning of this program, I was talking to the audience about how misinformed, and I'm not saying ideologically different, I'm saying just downright misinformed, that people see or read something on the internet and they think it's true. And that is so problematic. Yeah. That's a show in itself, but it is so problematic. So I'm glad that you brought that up. Let's do one more quick one. Michael Thompson, he is listening into the Black Vault Radio from Maryland. He says, Stephen, you won't remember me, but I attended your first X conference, which is where I met you. Seen you a few times since too. I love your talks. And Michael, thank you for this. At your conference, I also saw John Greenwald speak and learned about what official documents that he uncovered. I've been a fan of the Black Vault ever since. Michael, I appreciate that. You had great speakers then, and I loved it. Will you be planning another X conference?
There's no plans for another X conference at this point. If there is another one, it might be after disclosure. I spent everything I had and raised on the citizen hearing on disclosure, and then I raised some more money and I spent everything on that political initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And so right now PRG is operating with a few $100s. It's completely, and it's very difficult to raise any money because, as you know, since the election, the focus has just shifted.
Yeah.
We're in the middle of this hurricane, and the Through the Stars Academy is the big gaming town, and these are heavy-duty hitters with long careers. They've raised $2.5 million, and so they're there and they're leading. But PRG is—it's a very tough time for PRG. The funds are not there. I have a GoFundMe up, and I have a contribution page, and that's all well and good. But so I'm just at a point where there's not much I can do now. Hopefully that will change. But I don't expect too much to change until next year. I am speaking. I did 15 conferences this year already, and 21 lectures. And I was at the Alien Con. I was part of the premiere of the Ancient Aliens series this year. The first episode, the 2-hour episode, a very strong show. I recommend people watch the episode one of this year's Ancient Aliens. And I was at Alien Con in Pasadena, and I will be at Alien Con in Baltimore coming up in November. So I'm still here and I'm still talking, but don't have the funds to really make any movements. But if any major funding comes in, there's a lot of things I can do, John, and I'll give it a shot.
Well, his website is www.paradigmresearchgroup.org. I highly recommend checking it out. There's a lot of resources there. And as Stephen talked about earlier, that resource for the news headlines alone gives you an idea, if you're not already aware, about how widespread this issue is, how problematic it is, what the media is and is not covering. He has done an amazing job bringing that together. Not only do you have access to that, but a heck of a lot more. So again, ParadigmResearchGroup.org. Mr. Stephen Bassett, it is always, always a pleasure talking to you. I have a lot of fun. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day and spending it with me on the Black Vault Radio.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you. Although that concludes my interview with Mr. Stephen Bassett, don't go away. Coming up, we explore the CIA's family jewels. No, really. That's what they call it within their own declassified document. That's coming up on TBV Unredacted. In this episode's TBV Unredacted, I want to talk about a fun CIA document that surfaced a few years back. And in fact, this is actually one of the records, one of the few that mentions Operation Mockingbird. Now, I brought that up during my interview with Mr. Stephen Bassett a short while ago, and this is the document that came from. However, there's many more revelations in this, and this is known as what is called the Family Jewels document. not my nickname and not my reference, but the Family Jewels document is something that the CIA named, and this is their official explanation to what this is. Quote, widely known as the Family Jewels, this document consists of almost 700 pages of responses from CIA employees to a 1973 directive from Director of Central Intelligence James Schlesinger, asking them to report activities they thought might be inconsistent with the agency's charter. Now, the CIA released this thing under the Freedom of Information Act, and you can get it. I linked it in the show notes for you all, so you can download all 700 pages. But what this consisted of was kind of the bad of the bad, the worst of the worst, that the director at the time wanted to figure out what the employees were seeing, what they knew, and what bothered them. And in the beginning of this document, and there's probably more throughout the 700 pages, but it lists eight items of what is contained in this record, one of which, number three on the list, was Project Mockingbird. Here's the definition of Project Mockingbird according to this document. During the period from 12 March 1963 to 15 June 1963, this office installed telephone taps on two Washington-based newsmen who were suspected of disclosing classified information obtained from a variety of governmental and congressional sources. Part of Project Mockingbird was to control the media, to figure out what they were going to report, squash it if they could, but really keep tabs on what they were doing and how. Now, many records on Project Mockingbird, in my opinion, have been destroyed. There's not a bunch there, but it definitely was a project, and it does stretch back to the 1950s. And here we are in 1963, according to this record, where they were installing taps on journalists to figure out what that they were reporting. But that wasn't everything. Number one on the list is entirely redacted and blacked out. They won't even tell you what the number one thing on this Family Jewels document is. In my opinion, that's pretty interesting, because the Family Jewels document was written, I think finalized in 1973, and they made this compilation. So from 1973, here we are in 2018, whatever is that number one thing on the list, and they even went back to the 1940s, I believe, on what could hurt the CIA's image or what goes against what they were doing. Whatever number one is, completely redacted. Number two on the list was Johnny Roselli. Now, Johnny Roselli, I've gone after a lot of files. Maybe you'll hear about more of them in a future TBV Unredacted segment. But Roselli was used to plan and possibly attempt an assassination of Fidel Castro. He was a member of the mafia, and the CIA used him as an asset to potentially get into Cuba and find a way to assassinate Fidel Castro. Also on the list, Yuri Nisenko. He was a KGB defector, and he stayed in a specially constructed jail. The location of that jail is still classified. They have it blacked out. But he was confined in a cell with nothing but a cot. From 1965, August of 1965, through October of 1967. That's over 2 years to stay in a room with nothing but a cot. Also on there, various surveillance and support activities, support for local police officers, and a few other ones that they list right up top. I would recommend checking this out because it really does show you the lengths of how far they will go. And even the director of these agencies are not really aware of what is going on in their own agency. Now, for me, I kind of read between the lines. Why would the director of the CIA request that his own employees submit their concerns? Now, obviously, that's good leadership, so I don't fault him for that. But what he was asking and soliciting from them about what were the bad activities and projects and what concerned you, to me, I think that meant he was not in the know. That he was not aware of everything that his own agency was doing. So that is called the Family Jewels document. Again, there are 701 pages. So there is a lot of information to read. And you'll also see that there is a lot still redacted. So even though that they released this, there's a lot that's still classified. So when you read some of the other stuff, and I always recommend this, and you'll hear me say this time and time again, when you have a document that's fascinating and you can read it, and you read that information, you go, wow, that's really mind-blowing that they did that, or that they were planning that, or that they had an infrastructure in place for whatever. You read all that, and it's fascinating. But what is the stuff you can't read? And to me, it's like a gauge. You know, some of these documents, you just have to gauge on how important they are. And when you see something fascinating and it's not blacked out, really makes you wonder what is still classified. And not classified because it was a project 2 years ago. Classified in a project that was 40 years ago, 50 years ago, 60 years ago. That to me is amazing. So look at this document, read through it, post your thoughts. I'm always interested in your feedback. Make sure for future episodes, if you want to be involved in that TBV mailbag segment, get your name heard, or we can do it anonymous, make sure you subscribe to the Black Vault on Facebook, Twitter. I mostly put the TBV mailbag requests out on Facebook. So make sure that you pay attention to that, subscribe to it, and also subscribe to the podcast itself. I hope that this was an informative episode for you. I do appreciate your support in this program. I really, really enjoy bringing it to you. This is John Greenwald Jr. of the Black Vault Radio signing off. We'll see you next time.